Thank you for joining me for today's 6 CEU seminar regarding de-stressing and preventing burnout for therapists and counselors. I'll be your presenter for today, Michelle Sparks. I'm the owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling, a private practice here in suburban Columbus, Ohio. And just to give you a little background in terms of some of the work I've done, I actually started double majoring in elementary education and psychology. Then I got my master's at Loyola in counseling psych and went for advanced graduate studies at the University of Cincinnati. I did some supervising interns in the past and have worked primarily in private practice, both for other people's private practices as well as my own, and some community-based programs as well as hospital and other settings with collateral sources. So I've done a variety of counseling with kids and families, kids as young as 24 months, and play therapy, parenting, premarital, marital, individual adult counseling, relationship counseling, for a variety of different types of issues in terms of my scope of practice. So when I'm talking through examples today, might refer to things regarding different settings, different requirements of different work settings like productivity or marketing, timing, scheduling, self-care, and different factors that may contribute to stress or burnout. Throughout today's seminar, I'll be sharing with you a number of different little exercises or things for you to consider. Throughout today's seminar, we'll ask you to actually pause the audio and have paper and pen or pencil near you so you can do some brainstorming, so you can reflect on some different things we're going to talk about and do some of these exercises, because I think they're very beneficial in terms of practical ways of studying and looking at some of our expectations when we enter the field, some of the things we hope for versus some of the things that could be red flags for us in terms of stress and burnout. As we enter today's seminar, I'd like to begin by talking about the fact that stress, burnout, and just questioning our work in the field isn't really an abnormal thing. Sometimes after you've been in the mental health field as a mental health professional, you begin to think, oh boy, what I thought this was going to be is not quite what it has ended up being. Whether it's the setting, whether it's the affirmation or lack of affirmation, the compensation or lack thereof, the productivity, the requirements, the standards. We'll talk a little bit about expectations being a big part of why we went into the field versus what actually happens. And there are some practical things, as we'll learn today, that are areas that we can look at in terms of changing our thought patterns and changing our behaviors with regards to our expectations and various aspects of the therapeutic process. But what I want to highlight, and we'll highlight throughout today's seminar, is the fact that having stress ourselves about what we do, being pressured by the empathy of hearing a client's story, having sometimes possible symptoms of secondary traumatization, feeling pressure about productivity, marketing, making ends meet, and having thought patterns that are sometimes even obsessive about making sure we meet our clients' needs aren't totally abnormal. We'll talk about how the literature would suggest that anyone who has been a provider in the mental health field for any length of time, particularly once it approaches at least 8 to 10 years or more, or even for decades, will deal with stress and burnout. So as we go into this, you may be wanting to listen to this seminar because you're thinking, oh boy, am I really cut out for the field? Maybe I was optimistic about wanting to help and make a difference in people's lives, but I'm not so sure I'm cut out for this anymore. Or maybe you know you have a passion for helping people's lives, but just some of the associated tasks, the paperwork, the insurance, the marketing, the productivity standards, the agency and organizational types of related things, dealing with your coworkers, the lack of control that you have over who and what type of clients are put in your schedule. Maybe these are all factors that you're thinking of about, is this what I want to continue? And my hope is that as we go through today's seminar, you'll see that there are some factors that you can self-evaluate, that you can address in terms of the setting, the clientele, the schedule, the way you process what the work is that you're doing. There's just a number of factors to help de-stress, to help prevent burnout. But the questions that you may be facing or hear your colleagues facing are very, very normal and expected, especially in the type of work we do. I've made an audio that I would like you to listen to involving reflections from a counselor. As I think back about the 25 years that I've done counseling and mental health related work and some of the stuff that weighed on me, I felt like it might be helpful to you to realize you're not alone, that everyone that wants to be helpful, that desires to make a difference in people's lives as a helper, as a mentor, as someone who's teaching productive, pro-social skills to someone, has that heart and that burden and sometimes the side effects of what we want to do and the difference we want to make really are things that we begin to question. So take some time and listen to the audio of my reflection and then come back and we'll continue more about some of the information regarding de-stressing and preventing burnout. As we continue on the third slide here, we look at thinking about why did we even get into the field. It's important for us to consider, and I encourage you to really spend some time thinking about this right now, what it is that we do. So if you're a counselor, a social worker, psychologist, or any type of helper, why do we even get into this type of stuff to begin with? Usually, the literature shows that there are some byproducts of what we do. Think back. Maybe you were the type of person who just had a knack through the years, even when you were a child or a teen, or perhaps a young adult, to have a way of seeming to connect to other people through their pain. Maybe you were able to hear people's stories and to empathize with it in a way that it seemed that other people just couldn't do. There's a sense that possibly other people over time learned that you're a safe person, you're a listener, you might have a sense of perspective. They can come to you. There's some kind of vibe you gave off, whether it was even before you received your graduate training or your licensure. There was something about your character and your personality that showed that you were a safe person to connect to. Another reason we do what we do is because we have a knack for connecting to the vulnerability of others. We're able to empathize with the fact that life isn't always positive, that there's a lot of unpredictable sides of life, that anxiety, depression and other mood disorders, addiction, mental health symptoms of various kinds, and stress absolutely happen to people often just because they're human, just because they're in interpersonal relationships with others. So while we can identify and connect to the pain of others, and while we also are able to give a message to others by our behavior that they're welcome to share their vulnerability and they won't be shunned or judged for that, it also can put us at risk for feeling pain and vulnerability. Sometimes what we do actually involves feeling with a client. It involves witnessing sometimes trauma and despair. It involves hearing narratives of people that may be very painful. Even if you're a clinician, for example, that uses solution-focused or strengths-based therapy, just to hear the narrative about the presenting concerns that our clients bring to us oftentimes can be a point of tension, because you're having to understand the background to be able to empathize and relate to how did they get to this point? What's their perception about the contributing factors, as well as what is their perception about what would contribute to healing, health, wellness, or well-being in general? Another byproduct of what we do, in addition to connecting to pain, vulnerability, witnessing despair, and hearing these narratives, is we also can hear resiliency. Fact of the matter is that literature would even suggest that if we take in too much of the client's story as if it's our own story, it can drag us down, but it can also potentially lift us up. We can hear narratives of people who have survived some life circumstances, some abuses, some unpredictable events, some things that maybe we would have felt would have pulled us down. So there's a lot of byproducts of what we do. And one of the things that you may want to think about is when you go back to making that decision that you wanted to learn more about the mental health field, maybe consider what it was that you thought would be the byproducts of the work that you were doing. Did you think you'd be a listening ear for a person who maybe doesn't have too many people that are there for him or her in life? Did you think you'd bring optimism and perspective, possibly teaching skills without judging or demeaning a person? Did you just think you'd be available for them when they're not sure where their resources and the availability of other kind souls would come from? Sometimes I think part of the struggle we have is over time when we start to feel the natural byproducts of what we do, the byproduct of the stress of carrying other people's burdens with them and alongside them, we start to have these cognitive beliefs that I can't help someone else if I can't help myself. I can't give to the public. I can't pour out more. So what we're doing as a clinician is we are genuinely offering a service to the public, a much needed service. When I talk about, for example, the early studies in the 1960s and 70s about why what we do is significant, I make reference to the fact that there were studies that compared waiting list controls, talking to a family or friend, versus talking to someone that had some techniques as well as high levels of Rogers process variables. And we find out that it's not because we've mastered everything in our own lives. It's not because we have all the answers and we never have stresses or we don't battle some of the things even that our clients might battle. But it's because we're real, we're sincere, we demonstrate respect, we're giving room for the narrative to be heard. We're providing a service, and what we're doing is skills, giving a client skills that actually would suggest that what we do is even more meaningful in terms of even measured, when it's measured, statistically significant difference compared to talking to just a friend or a family member. So I like to think about what's in your well. If you think of your life as a clinician, as a sort of bank account, what is it that you allow to deposit into it? And what are the things that take from it? For example, do you have the mindset of, I'll just take on more clients. I'll just a few more. I can help a few more people, even though this certain type of clientele is really burdening to me. Are we spending time balancing out our personal and professional life? Do we have a network of colleagues, especially at the agency or in the setting that we're in, that can help build a scope of practice, can help discuss with us similar cases in that similar setting? What is it that fills us up? Are we choosing continuing education and similar training that is helping us build our competency areas with the types of clientele that we are working with? I always tell clients, which you might be familiar with telling your clients as well, the idea that self-care is not selfish. But honestly, I encourage you to ask yourself at this point in time, do you really believe that about yourself as a clinician? What happens when it comes time when you're starting to get a cold or you need to take a day off to rest and replenish or you want some time with your own loved ones and this other little voice in your head is saying, oh, but your clients need you, but they might have a crisis, but such and such might happen, but you just need to work harder and be available and be the helper and be the expert. Sometimes we almost come in with this idea of do more, work harder, be more, be the answer. And I think that's a dangerous position to be in. One of the reasons I love solution-focused, strengths-based type of work is because it sets up an expectation initially that therapy is a partnership. It's a partnership between you as a therapist and someone coming to you for a presenting concern where there is some level of responsibility both on you but also on the client. I think it's very helpful to set this up off the bat. One way I do that is I will set the expectation initially that I do like to give quote-unquote homework or little practical things that people can do outside of session to try and focus on skills that we've role-played or that I've provided resources on in session. I remind myself that one of the roles I do not want to set up, either for myself or for a client, is that I'm an expert. Sometimes I find towards this end, it's good to have in your array of different things that you have at your office or in your setting, a form letter that talks about what the scope of practice of someone with your license, with your education, and in the particular setting that you're in, is. So, for example, I might put on mine that my scope of practice as an LPCC includes diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders with children, families, individual adults, couples, and groups. I would clarify what that scope of practice involves and what it doesn't involve, because that way we can clarify an LPCC in a private practice, for example, is not a doctor. I'm not going to be giving advice, opinions, directions about medication. I'm not going to be prescribing. I'm not going to have the scope of practice of a mediator who's deciding custody matters. I'm not going to be a case manager in the community who is giving access to resources. But what I'm going to be doing is office-based psychotherapy. I'm going to be looking at the presenting concerns and finding out what things in our DSM are consistent with the symptom picture that my client's bringing in, and then looking at providing skills for that. That, having that in writing, really, I know for me, it feels very, very freeing, because that way you're being very clear about this is who I am, this is who I'm not. And you may have to not just have that in writing, but also state it at various times. When a client's saying, for example, I just need some meds. I think I need some meds for this anxiety. I can't calm down. You know, that way you could, again, clarify that your scope of practice is not giving advice or dispensing of any medications, but that you can give techniques for anxiety reduction. You can do cognitive behavioral therapy about things. You can communicate prior release of consent with a doctor who maybe could do some additional work to supplement what you're doing. So it's freeing to be able to realize who I am and who I'm not. One of the other things I think is very helpful when we talk about therapeutic alliance is the fact that it took time for the toxic behaviors, thoughts, the patterns that don't work for the clients and that contribute to the presenting concerns to evolve. So I like to even share with a client that what took time to develop and get to the point now where they believe that they need help may take a little time and a process to undo. That any new habits for all of us, and I love using us and we language, because again, it normalizes, I'm one of us too. It's not just you, the clients who come in the office, but all of us. Just because we're humans, sometimes we do over and over the same things that don't make sense and that are reinforce those bad habits. But just because wounds took place in relationship, so too healing can take place through the therapeutic alliance as well as outside through application of what they're learning. I'd like to read to you a quote to this end that I included. If we believe that healing takes place in relationship, then the healing of counselor impairment and the promotion of counselor wellness will also take place in relationship, not simply in the intrinsically hierarchical relationships between a counselor and client, a counselor educator and a counselor trainee, or a supervisor and supervisee, but more generally in the quote between of the relationships among all counselors in the profession. This I find interesting because there's so much literature about therapeutic alliance. I mean, when we start in grad school, that's one of the very first things that is foundational, is what things build a therapeutic alliance, what things destroy the therapeutic alliance. But beyond that, We need to look at what's life-giving and what fills us up. And who can understand another counselor or clinician better than some of our own colleagues? Yet, at many different agencies and settings I've worked at to this point, to 2020, I have found, whether it be a community mental health setting, people were too busy to meet, aside for 1 hour a week for a staff meeting that involved a lot of policy and procedure stuff, but not a lot of clinical checking in about cases. I find that in past private practice settings, everyone was so busy keeping up with trying to get enough clients and to keep their schedule busy to pay their bills and to market. And when they were seeing clients, they couldn't interact with other staff. So people would have different patterns where we would tend at different practices to see each other coming and going. The counseling field in particular, to be quite honest, doesn't have the lobbying and the supports among each other the way some of the other fields do. That's why one of the things that could be very helpful to us is learning to reach out early on, regardless of the setting you're in. Whether you're in a community mental health and you're having productivity standards and regulations to jump through, and everyone's busy trying to meet those, or whether you're in a private practice and you're feeling rather isolated, you know, about even setting times to see or meet with colleagues, it's very important to make having relationship with other clinicians important. That does so many things. It normalizes some of the concerns and frustrations we have. It holds us accountable to different things in the field, to our ethical standards, to our level of care, to our decision making, and just keeps us on track. Mindfulness would suggest that there is a real importance of having caring and connection with others. If there's one thing you'll probably hear repetitiously throughout today's seminar, it is about social connection. The literature talks extensively about social connection, both with others in our similar field doing mental health work, as well as social connection in terms of leisure outside the mental health work we do. So we're talking about both professionally and personally. It talks about, in the mindfulness literature, not striving, not struggling to try and meet some criteria and behavior and, you know, if I do enough, but just being in the present. That's really hard if you're working in a setting that, you know, is so productivity driven. You probably don't hear that. You probably don't hear that a lot about support for time to actually use your comp time. I remember at an agency I used to work at, it was not uncommon for many of us to have to let all the extra comp time that we accrued just go, because it was a vicious cycle of, you know, you use the time to get to the productivity, and then if you take the time off, then you're not going to be there to get more productivity. So one of the best things we can do is give ourselves permission and our colleagues permission, not just to do and be more excellently in the field, but also just to be present, just to have acceptance of who we are, just to accept the fact that we're not, quote, the experts. We're not really the be-end and be-all and you know, the end of everything. Yes, we may have more experience in education than our clients do, but honestly, they may have, on another level, more experience and have survived some amazing things and conquered some amazing things when we hear their narrative. So mindfulness is very freeing in terms of, I don't have to measure up. I don't have to just do more work. When I do cognitive behavioral therapy with clients, I talk with them about the red flags. And some of them that I discuss with them are things like have to's, shoulds, ought to. If only I do A, B, and C, then such and such good outcome will happen. And then one I frequently talk to them about is, if only I did, quote, enough. And when they're learning cognitive debating skills, we'll talk about why the word enough is such a limiting word. It gives us a false perception that somehow we need to be on this pedestal. We need to have these answers and come up with these grand ideas for our clients. Sometimes one of the things that we can role model that is most helpful in terms of spilling over into a successful therapeutic alliance is learning to love ourselves. I've cited another quote here that I think is important for us to consider. You can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anyone in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. See, if we're talking to a client, for example, about self-care or boundaries, and then they see us rapidly darting in the office, doing five things at once, not having time to answer our phone calls, half asleep, trying to eat in between things, and see that we're feeling scattered, that we're stressed, that maybe our self-care isn't the greatest, that gives a different message. I don't know how many of you might have had that experience of telling clients that our behavior teaches those around us more than just what we say. And you know, that can go just as much for us as a therapist. Is our behavior really demonstrating to clients that we believe in our own personal life that being is as important as doing? That we're worth love and respect as much as what we try to tell our clients. Now, I would encourage you to take out that paper and pen or pencil that I made reference to a little bit ago. And I want you to take some time to contemplate a few different phrases that I'm going to share with you. You know, we talk in our field about having operational definitions, concrete, observable, manageable, behavioral ways of defining things. So as I'm talking about these words or phrases, I want you to think in terms of what concrete behaviors would demonstrate this. So the first phrase that I'd like you to think about, what comes to your mind when you think about being safe? Keep in mind, this is important because we try to create an environment for our clients of what we would call safety or security. But what does that mean for us? Are we extending that to ourselves? Do we include in our own personal life opportunities to set boundaries with people, be it relatives, colleagues, friends or family, about what feels safe to us? Not just safety from, you know, lack of harm to self or others, but emotional safety. And like I said, if you need to pause the audio between these to think more about these, I would highly encourage you to do this. Because the exercises I'm going to go through and the things to think about today, I don't want you just to rush through. I want this to be something that helps you to really think therapeutically about what you need to be healthy and as well as you can be as a practicing clinician. The second phrase I want you to think about is being happy. The reason I bring that one up is that can be awfully subjective. Think about how our clients come to us, and so many of them have a presenting concern about stress or depression. And they just say, I want to be happy. But you know, so many of us also inside feel like, wow, I'm not so sure the last time I was truly, genuinely happy. Just fulfilled, just joyous in life. Didn't have to explain away why I was just enjoying myself. So think about what would constitute true happiness for you. And then a third phrase that I'd like you to take time contemplating is being healthy. What would that be? I know sometimes we talk about health in terms of physical health. Sometimes we're talking about emotional health. But I think they all tie together. I remember back when I worked for other people's practices, and I worked in buildings where there were a variety of different mental health professionals and different practices, seeing various clinicians and colleagues of mine all skipping lunch, going easily through 10 and 12 hour days without breaks or with a small bathroom break, but not really eating a healthy meal. I saw people go into the pop machine downstairs at one of the places I worked at where they might get a pop to try and stay awake or make a cup of coffee in between or have an energy drink or a little meal bar of some sort, but not really a meal. So again, we tell our clients is that there's one standard for them and a different standard for us. Be healthy. Make sure you're eating and sleeping. Make sure you're doing your activities of daily living. But do we do that? I don't think that we're the best at it. In fact, the literature in terms of stress and burnout from clinicians would show the opposite. It would show that those of us who serve others and encourage others are rather hypocritical. That many of us, when we need outside help or could benefit from it, won't consider going to a therapist ourselves because we pressure ourselves to mentally just figure it out. We won't allow ourselves to do the self-care to have a healthy life. A lot of times we reason, well, someday, maybe after I've done A, B, and C, I'll be able to get to that. But again, habits, if our habits are don't eat, don't sleep well, obsess about your clients, do things for your clients, it's going to be really hard to change and undo those. So take a little time to contemplate what being healthy would be like for you. And then finally, this last phrase I want you to think about is the phrase living with ease. That might sound like a rather bizarre phrase, but the idea behind it, I think, is everything doesn't have to be a matter of hard work and being drained and being unhappy and just drudging through things. That there is a point at which being, relating, sometimes just having a simplicity to our life can be helpful. Let's talk about self-care a little bit. If you're still, like most of us in the field, thinking like, yeah, okay, I know, I've heard it, we know self-care is important, but your behavior's not lining up, Let's talk about why self-care. Why is this important for us as clinicians? One, it can lessen our emotional reactivity. We're obviously supposed to rein in our emotions so that we can be present for our clients and for the work we do. But how many times do you find yourself inside after you've gone through so many clients in your day, feeling frustrated, feeling tired, thinking like, oh my, how many more do I have to go? Okay, a few more hours, a little bit more time. Oh, I hope this next one's not going to be as bad as the last one. That self-care and having the balance can also help us in the moment to emotionally regulate. It can help us improve relationship skills. Again, our behavior, just like our clients' behavior, teaches other people what to think of us. It can improve wellness, just our sense of well-being. One of the things I do want to say, and again, I'll probably say this several times throughout today's seminar, is that wellness is both an outcome and a process. What I mean by that is there are some habits of self-care. There are some behaviors like time with colleagues, like balancing leisure and work, that can be related to wellness. But the fact is, wellness is not something we necessarily arrive at and we're done once and for all. And I think that's where this issue of stress and burnout especially comes in. Because sometimes we think, well, shoot, I've worked in the mental health field for years. Why am I still stressed about this type of client? Why are these other areas still things that I don't like involving paperwork and policies and procedures of where I work? So wellness is a journey. It is a process. And that's something that we can also role model, both for our colleagues, within ourselves, and our clients will pick up on it. Whether, you know, you share in words or not about your personal journey, they can tell. Another positive side effect to self-care is optimism and hope. When I've done seminars on hope, I've talked about how hope is one of the biggest factors that can make a difference for clients. That one of the things clients say has made a positive difference for them is feeling like we have helped them to have resources and techniques about how to find optimism or hope in spite of what initially was perceived negatively. I don't know if you remember in the literature, Martin Seligman, and he did the studies with the dogs on learned helplessness, that over time, if certain things were paired together with a negative outcome, that someone would learn to feel helpless. But more recently, Martin Seligman has done studies on something that he calls learned optimism, which is fascinating to me, because that would suggest that even if there's some struggles we've had as a mental health therapist, even there's some, though there may be some things that we feel are very challenging for us, there is a possibility of learning behaviors that would suggest a gratitude attitude, as I put it. Another side effect of self-care is improved physical health, better quality of life, decreased overall level of stress, and greater balance in life. Now, earlier I talked about making sure there's balance between being and doing. So it's not just about doing more and jumping through more hoops and working harder and doing, quote, enough. One of the phrases or words in the literature that speaks to this is the word presence. This is talking about a way of being with our clients a way of interacting and applying techniques. What presence is refers to really having high levels of Rogers process variables. It means being authentically in a relationship, being real. When I teach this seminar on multicultural counseling, I highlight that even when a clinician may not understand all the ins and outs and beliefs of a person's culture from an experiential point of view, clients have said in terms of multicultural competency that they prefer someone who comes across as sincere, that comes across as wanting to know and wanting to be, like really, really actually not just saying it, but wanting to be in that therapeutic relationship. When we talk about the power of being present, we're talking about empathy. Not just saying we understand or acting the part of understanding, but truly being able to summarize and in words that the client would say, yeah, you get it. We talk about support, and that might even involve us actually asking a client, what would you find to support? I find a lot of clients during their first diagnostic assessment session, when I ask them what are they looking for from counseling, will tell me that they're looking for, quote, support. And again, we can really benefit by using operational definitions. Does support to them just mean I'm quiet, I shut up, stare at them, and nod my head? For most clients, that's not what they mean. I've even had some clients tell me that, unfortunately, they had clinicians in the past who did just that. For other clients, the nonverbals of really attending to them means support. But for many clients, support might be defined as, hear my narrative, but offer me some practical solutions and skills from here to show me that you understand and that you're cheering me on, basically, towards better ways to deal with my presenting concerns. When we talk about the power of presence, we're also talking about being willing to explore issues, to collaborate with others. As a clinician, again, we are looking at collaborating with other collateral sources, collaborating with people who can be a support to us, and appreciating other people and the impact they can have. When we're present in those situations, what happens is certain things are a positive side effect. Presence shows other people that they can trust us, that we're sincere, that there's a warmth about us, that we really are attuned to their story and their narrative. There's a sense of potency and strength in being present. It reinforces that we're competent. There's respect, attentiveness, engaged listening, lack of judgment, and just moment-to-moment being. When we talk about mindfulness and self-care, mindfulness is talking about maintaining awareness and attention to ourself, being purposeful. So this can be about just attending to our body movements. Are we constantly restless and shaking our foot when we're kind of tapping, thinking, oh boy, I want this session to end? Are we doing things faster and more panicky to try and get more things done at our job? Or are we having a well-paced out day where we're able to do what we can, but we're realistic about it? Is there balance emotionally and psychologically if we need personal counseling or could benefit from someone helping us in terms of any life stresses? Do we seek that out? Is there balance between our clinical work time and personal time? What about spiritually? Whether that means actual spiritual practices in terms of religion, spirituality, and formalized religion, whether that just means about who I am and how I'm able to be my best self. Self-care and mindfulness also involve obtaining and reaching out for support. And I want to add to that, without shame. I think sometimes we think that as clinicians, and again, people out there have this idea as, quote, experts, that we're not supposed to have needs. I even had someone years ago actually tell me. They're like, oh, well, we didn't expect you to need any help in the community or in this because you're a counselor. You should know how to deal with everything. And I thought, wow, I'm not God. How in the world am I supposed to know everything? And part of that is us allowing ourselves to role model within ourselves, but also to clients that vulnerability is okay. That we don't have to have every answer figured out ahead and do everything perfectly. Self-care and mindfulness also involves self-awareness. I find that for most clinicians, though, we can't develop that self-awareness on our own. That the knowledge of our own thoughts, emotions, and behaviors really mostly comes through relationships with other colleagues, because then they're able to see from without. That's why I suggest that even if you're independently licensed, it's very important to have connection with other people for supervision. Because whether you, quote, need supervision or not, it's something that can help you ethically. It can keep you in check. It can help you process things that you might not even be aware of. Now, I want to say something that I want you to pay special attention to. Self-care activities do not necessarily require self-awareness. Self-care activities, which are also mindful, are what creates wellness. So, we can either do self-care as a sort of checklist, where again it just becomes a task, but it's not life-giving, or we can do self-care with mindfulness, where we're creating awareness, where it's not just judgment and checking another thing off of the list. And that's where the outcome and the process of wellness comes in. One of the things that might be useful for you to contemplate as well now is the idea of what you consider your self-identity. Basically, who am I? I find that a lot of times when clients are coming in, to some degree they struggle with that, just like we might struggle with that. What I'm saying is that being a mental health professional is really only part of the big picture. For example, there's many things to define who Michelle Sparks is. One portion of that is things related to my LPCC, my experiences with that, what it's like to be a clinician in a private practice in suburban Columbus, Ohio, what my previous work experiences have been, what type of clientele are within my scope of practice and competency. But there's many, many, many other aspects to who I am. And sometimes when we focus on the stress and burnout, we're basically hyper-focusing on just that one part of who we are as a mental health professional. So if I were to think about who Michelle Sparks is, I might think of what are my talents and abilities, not just in terms of helping people with clinical mental health issues, but in terms of writing, in terms of speaking, playing music, volunteering in the community or the church, creative projects I do with my girls, things that I'm involved with my family. I also think about what hobbies I like. What are my values and beliefs? What are the things I hold dear to myself that make me who I am? And what roles do I have to others? Not just the role as a mental health professional, but as a mother, as a wife, for me as a Christian, as a community member, as someone with certain belief systems. What does that mean? Now, I wanted to share a little bit about an article on counselor identity and wellness. One of the things we look at are what they call in the literature developing the five selves. They talk about the creative self, the coping self, the social self, the essential self, and the physical self. These are all different components to who we are as a whole person. So the first one, the creative self, talks about our thoughts, our emotions, work, and positive humor. The coping self includes our leisure time, our stress management, our self-worth, and realistic beliefs about things. Some of this can go back to the strengths-based sorts of questions that solution-focused approach would have. I encourage you to even apply that to your life right now. That idea of how have you, fellow counselor and clinician, how have you managed to this point in spite of some of the pressures with some of the agencies you worked at? How have you managed with some difficult clients? How have you managed with some challenging colleagues? How have you managed to focus on doing your job when you had your own health issues, when you had your own interpersonal problems, when you had your own needs and presenting concerns? So we talked about the creative self, the coping self. Then thirdly, we have the social self. The social self speaks of friendship and connection, which I refer to in terms of support systems, both on a friendly level and on a professional level. The essential self, things like who do you say you are spiritually in terms of your identity, and your physical self, things like nutrition and exercise. All of these play into who we are. I'd like you to take a little time, and you may want to set a timer here for 5 to 10 minutes. There are some operational definitions I want you to come up with for some of the roles that we do as a helper, because it's really important for you to think of what these mean to you so that you don't put undue pressure on yourself. So first of all, helping. What does it mean to be a helper? Is your belief, for example, that I have to fix? I have to come up with solutions for everything? Or is it more of a belief of I'm in a therapeutic partnership with a person who has a need and concern? We're working through the story of their life and coming up with some other ways of approaching certain issues. What does being a helper mean? Can helpers have their own boundaries? Can helpers need help? Are helpers allowed to be vulnerable? Take some time to think about what being a helper means to you. What about counseling? I know one of the things in grad school we're taught is counseling is not advice giving. It's not making a decision for another person. But what is counseling really to you? Is it something that is a career? Does it pay the bills? Is it making an impact in someone else's life? Is it providing hope? Is it giving people life skills for productive living that they may not have had to that point? What is treating a client? What does treatment mean? Now, some of the rest of these have to do with emotions I want you to think about. Things like fear, sadness, anger, grief, or courage. I remember when I was in grad school, one of the first things they said is that we needed to clarify that emotions were not good or bad, but they might be pleasant or unpleasant. And I think that's something that some of you might need to be reminded of. Having your own fears about, wow, what if I don't have the magic answers for all my clients? What if the client's narrative really hits home about some things I went through in my life? What about sadness? What about when I hear something from a client that really targets things that just break my heart? What about anger? I know for me, for example, anger inside might be like when I hear about someone who was a helpless child and they were a victim of some type of abuse and they felt like they couldn't escape, they couldn't tell anyone, they weren't allowed to do anything. And just that anger over the injustice of now they're struggling with feeling that they're going to betray someone who did something toxic to them. And what about grief? Let's also consider what the operational definition of courage is and strength. I know, for example, for me, when I meet with clients, a lot of times I'll tell them, you know, I see you as a survivor. You've told me that you've been through A, B, C events in your life, and you probably feel like anything but a survivor. But I want you to know that I see it as courageous to even take a step to meet with someone else and be vulnerable. Resiliency, what does that look like? Empathy and compassion. Now, there's a really neat article that I wanted to cite here regarding reasons we find our work satisfying. I'd encourage as we go through these, you to think about or write down which of these several reasons might pertain to why you like doing what you do in the mental health field. The key when we're talking about overcoming stress and burnout is really reminding ourselves what it is that was the driving force behind getting in the field in the first place. So let's look at one of the first reasons some people find the mental health work satisfying is because they're a spectator. They like observing and hearing about the lives of others. They like to hear the narratives. It's fascinating. Does that apply to you? What about altruism? many of us feel like we like to make a difference in someone else's life. Control. I know that word might seem difficult for some of you, but control in the sense of you do feel powerful. You do feel like you've made a difference when you've contributed to helping, fixing, or knowing something, whether it be a technique, giving a handout, role-playing some new skill for a client. Another reason some people find the work we do as satisfying is intimacy. The idea of having a close connection with the life of someone else. Learning. We learn as much from our clients and colleagues as they might learn from us. So just through human interaction, we can obtain knowledge about human behavior. There's growth as we seek to self-evaluate and to increase our mindfulness and awareness. One of the things that's very satisfying for many people as well is creativity. Developing new ways of looking at similar issues. This is something when we talk later about the types of things and settings that either prevent or contribute to burnout, creativity is one of the key ones. There needs to be clear expectations in a setting about what your role as a mental health clinician is, but then also freedom to be creative on an appropriate level of autonomy, given where you're at in terms of your, your level of development in terms of maybe your experience, your competency. There's other reasons we also find our work satisfying. Sometimes, honestly, we do like the drama. I know there's plenty of jokes out there where people are like, well, why in the world were you getting to the mental health field? I mean, I have friends and relatives who sometimes tell me, man, that would stress me out. Why would you want to do that kind of stuff? But honestly, let's think about this. How many of us do get a charge out of having some intense therapeutic encounters? I mean, it's nice to have to problem solve to hear. Another thing that we find satisfying is hearing the narratives of others, hearing the story of how they get to this point. That's what I love. I know for me, that's one of the big ones that I find satisfying is just that every client's different. I could have 10 depressed people on my caseload, but for one, their depression looks one way, for another, it looks the other way. But yet, person A who's saying they're depressed still is getting up, taking care of their kids, doing their day-to-day tasks, maybe with low motivation and not with a high level of enthusiasm, but they're trying. Another person, their depression looks differently. What about arousal? Arousal means feeling with someone. So sometimes that can be motivating to us as clinicians. We also can be motivated by mentoring, meaning teaching or retraining someone. Like I said, that habits, even bad habits, take a while to develop and take a while to have new habits. We also often find satisfying the idea of curiosity. We're in a business, so to speak, of unraveling cues about why things are the way they are and what can help. It's important for us, for example, to hear what someone believes contributes to their health, their illness, their wellness, why they got to the way that they got, and what the solutions might be. See, we've been taught a lot about the supremacy of the medical model, but the fact of the matter is that there's a whole lot of people out there who don't believe that. We have clients who don't believe in the biochemical piece. We have clients who maybe have other explanations for why they are the way they are. Whether it's personality, whether it's spirituality, whether it's cultural beliefs, there's a lot of reasons that people believe they are the way they are. And so it's helpful to learn and find out what their explanation is. Another reason we might find our work satisfying is the challenge of even dealing with resistance. Now, I know a lot of us at first glance would say, that's not exciting. Why would I be excited about resistance? But it keeps us on our toes. It helps us realize that what the clients may be acting out in the session is just another variation of what they're acting out in day-to-day life. And a final thing that we find satisfying about our work is reflecting, observing, and testing out our own intuition. Now, what tends to stress us out can also be resistance from clients. Clients' anger, clients' low motivation and depression and lethargy. Systems issues, family system where it feels like, gosh, this is beyond me. This has happened around them so much and been so reinforced, I don't know what I'm going to do here. Dealing with agency protocol. So there's all these hoops and policies to go through to where, for many of us, it steals a joy away from us. Insurance companies. We have to diagnose, we have to put things in a certain format to be able to get paid. Time pressures can stress us out. You know, you could think of certain clients where you wish you could just spend more time hearing what they're saying, being present, and taking the time to even help them work through things even more than what you are. Organizational policies and politics of who does what and who's the chain of command and whatever can stress us out. In fact, I remember one of our colleagues who said in one of his CEU seminars, he said, don't raise your hand and don't give an example, but just within yourself. How many of you think you know not just one person, but probably several people in your years of experience as a mental health clinician that might seem like they might have a mental health diagnosis themselves or some personality issues? And so many people attested to the fact that they feel like within the agencies that people have dealt with, that many of us have seen those dynamics among our colleagues. We can have difficult colleagues or supervisors. You can have someone who you believe doesn't understand you. Things like excessive paperwork or productivity with lack of money or recognition. Things in our personal life, like issues at home or health issues, can weigh on things. So those are things that we want to look at. So what I'd like to do is for you to take time to write, before we get to this next section, if you could write down a narrative about what you expected of the mental health field when you started out getting your training, and what you believe is expected of you in your current job setting. What your company, your agency, or whatever the setting is you're working in expects of you. And we're going to use that in this next section in just a little bit. So if you can pause and write down again, when you went into the mental health field, what is it that your expectations were? What did you expect of a job setting versus what's actually happened? And then we're going to use that as we talk through stress and burnout.